From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
But you're being less forthcoming with this committee than just about any other person who has come before us. You are so bright, and you know so much. But there's another aspect to this, which is letting us know what you think.
It's day four of the confirmation of Judge John Roberts as Chief Justice of the United States. We'll play excerpts of the hearing and speak with legal experts Ted Shaw of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Peter Irons, author of A People's History of the Supreme Court. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Iraq, a suicide car bomber has killed at least 21 people after he rammed his car into a convoy of police vehicles in Baghdad. This comes a day after 150 people died in one of the bloodiest days of the Iraq War. In the deadliest incident on Wednesday, up to 114 Shiite day laborers were killed after they were lured to a car packed with explosives. Over a dozen other attacks were reported in Iraq Wednesday, injuring as many as 600 people. Meanwhile, a tape recording purportedly from Abu Musab al-Zarqawi claims the series of attacks were staged as revenge for the U.S.-led assault on the Iraqi city of Tal Afar. Since Saturday, U.S. and Kurdish forces have been waging a massive attack on the northern city and the largest U.S. offensive since the siege of Fallujah. The U.S. is also coming under criticism in Iraq by the country's Minister of Justice, Abdul Hussein Shandal. In an interview with Reuters, he condemned the U.S. military for arresting Iraqis without a warrant and for holding thousands of them without charge. The Justice Minister also said he wants to strip immunity from foreign troops. The state of Texas has executed Frances Newton. She was killed by lethal injection shortly after 6 o'clock Texas time last night, despite widespread calls for a stay of her execution. She's the first African-American woman to be executed in Texas since Reconstruction. Her supporters included Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, the Austin American statesman, and the head of the American Bar Association. Numerous questions were raised about whether Newton received a fair trial when she was convicted of killing her husband and two children 18 years ago. Her state-appointed attorney, Ron Mock, did not interview a single witness in preparation for her trial. He has since been barred from handling capital cases due to incompetence. Hours before her execution, the Supreme Court denied a petition to stop her execution. On Capitol Hill, today is the fourth day of confirmation hearings for John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. On Wednesday, Democrats repeatedly accused him of not answering questions about his personal beliefs. Senator Joseph Biden said Roberts was acting, quote, as if the public doesn't have a right to know what you think about fundamental issues facing them. We'll have more on the hearings just after headlines. On Capitol Hill, Republicans have blocked several efforts by Democrats to seek investigations or information on Hurricane Katrina, the Iraq War, and the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. In the Senate, Republicans killed a proposal by Hillary Clinton for an independent investigation of the government's response to Katrina. Her proposal was rejected on a party-line vote of 54 to 44. A new CNN USA Today Gallup poll shows 70% of the country supports an independent investigation. In the House, Republicans rejected attempts by Democrats to force the Bush administration to surrender documents on pre-war intelligence about Iraq connected to the Downing Street memo. The memo revealed the minutes of a July 2002 meeting between British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his advisors that indicate the United States was already committed to attacking Iraq almost a year before the war officially began. The memo also says the Bush White House, quote, fixed intelligence data to justify the invasion. Also on Wednesday, Republicans on the Judiciary and International Relations Committees rejected attempts by Democrats to compel the Bush administration to turn over information and records related to the outing of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. In other news on Hurricane Katrina, the Knight Ridder News Agency is reporting that it was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff who was ultimately empowered to mobilize the federal response to Hurricane Katrina, not Michael Brown, the former head of FEMA, who resigned earlier this week. Internal records showed that Chertoff didn't shift power to Brown until 36 hours after Katrina hit. According to Knight Ridder, Chertoff, even before the storm struck, could have ordered federal agencies into action without any requests from state or local officials. According to the National Response Plan, it was Chertoff, not Brown, who was in charge of managing the national response to a catastrophic disaster. Knight Ridder is also reporting it has obtained an internal memo that suggests Chertoff may have been confused himself about his lead role in disaster response and that of his department. In Israel, the country's highest court has ordered the government to tear down part of the 400-mile separation wall in the West Bank because it imprisons thousands of Palestinian residents. The court ruled the wall as a whole was a justified security measure, but it ordered the dismantling of a small section in the northern West Bank. Last year, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled that parts of the wall are illegal and should be torn down. This is Palestinian Minister Ghassan Khatib.
The part of the Israeli High Court resolution of moving the wall into the green line near Qalqilya area is welcomed from the Palestinian side, because we hope that Israel will move all the wall to the green line and stop building a wall inside the Palestinian territories.
Palestinian Minister Ghassan Khatib. Kenneth Tomlinson, the chair of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, may have violated internal rules by hiring a consultant to assess the political leanings of public television shows. This, according to Kenneth Kantz, the inspector general of the CPB. Kantz is in the process of investigating a series of complaints against Tomlinson, including his secret hiring of Frederick Mann to monitor programs, including now with Bill Moyers. Kantz told the Bloomberg News Agency, quote, clearly there are indications of possible violations. There are situations where the board doesn't know what's going on and the chairman needs to operate in a more accountable fashion, he said. Bloomberg reports Kantz may recommend that Tomlinson be barred from serving as director of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. At Guantanamo, three more hunger-striking detainees have been hospitalized. 21 detainees are now in the hospital after refusing to eat for over a month. Lawyers for the detainees say as many as 200 of them are taking part in the hunger strike. The Pentagon has put the total at 128. There are about 500 detainees at the prison camp. In Haiti, the country's electoral council is attempting to block jailed priest Gerard Jean-Just from running for president in Haiti's first election since the coup that ousted Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The council is refusing to enroll Jean-Just as a candidate, claiming he has to enter his candidacy in person, not from prison. Father Jean-Just is the candidate of choice for the Lavalas party, the same party of Aristide. Jean-Just has been in jail since July, but he has not yet been charged with any crimes. Amnesty International has classified him as a prisoner of conscience. An American peace activist has been deported from Australia after he was accused of being a threat to national security. On Saturday, Scott Parkin was detained by six federal police and immigration officials as he sat at a cafe in Melbourne where he was teaching workshops on peaceful protest. He's best known for organizing protests around the military contractor Halliburton in this country and in Australia. The Australian government said he was deported earlier today. On Wednesday, Parkin issued a statement saying, quote, to this date, the only information I've received is that I've been assessed as a direct or indirect risk to Australian national security. In labor news, the union Unite Here has officially withdrawn from the AFL-CIO, joining three other dissident unions, the Service Employees International Union, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and United Food and Commercial Workers. With the defections, the size of the AFL-CIO's membership has dropped from 13 to 9 million.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, A hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told.
The Mercy Seat, Johnny Cash, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and the viewers. And Amy, the song so appropriate now with the terrible news that Frances Newton was executed yesterday evening. She becomes the 349th person executed by the state of Texas since it restored the death penalty in 1982, the 11th woman executed in the United States since 1976, and the first African-American woman since Reconstruction to be executed.
This despite the efforts by Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee, American Bar Association, NAACP, American Bar Association. In fact, we'll talk with Ted Shaw later as we talk about the Roberts hearings and hear Senator Leahy questioning Roberts about the death penalty. We'll ask Attorney Ted Shaw about Frances Newton and the whole issue of the death penalty in the Supreme Court. There are other headlines, Juan, as well.
Yes, well, and also here in New York City, the mayoral race at least was finally decided yesterday. Fernando Ferrer, who had gotten the most votes by far in Tuesday's primary for Democratic primary for mayor, but had fallen apparently just shy of the 40% threshold. He'd gotten 39.95% of the vote, but there was still about 8,000 absentee ballots to be counted. Suddenly yesterday, Congressman Anthony Weiner, his leading opponent, conceded the election and threw his support to Fernando Ferrer, just thus uniting virtually all the Democrats in New York City in the race that will occur in November now, the election in November, against Republican billionaire Michael Bloomberg. So it was an unexpected decision by Weiner because it avoided a costly and possibly divisive runoff election in 2 weeks between the two leading Democratic candidates.
So that they wouldn't be focusing on each other, but now right away focusing on the Republican, Michael Bloomberg. And the Union Unite Here has pulled out?
Yes, that was expected. Unite Here has now joined the new coalition of trade unions that is developing along with SEIU. And now we're going to be able to see whether there really is any difference in the political thrust of these two new centers now of the organized labor movement. But also, interestingly, Amy, in today's New York Times, an interview with Michael Brown, the former head of FEMA, where Brown apparently is refusing to be the fall guy for the disastrous response of the federal government. In an interview with the Times, he claims that within a day of the disaster of the Hurricane Katrina striking the Gulf Coast, he was on the phone with Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security chief, and called Andrew Card, the White House chief of staff, saying that the state and local authorities were overwhelmed and needed federal assistance, but that for some reason the response from his superiors was not rapid and quick. So Brown is now diming out the rest of the people in the Bush administration and saying it wasn't me, it was my superiors who didn't listen to me. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any kind of an independent investigation to sort out what really happened.
Well, the Republicans are fighting that certainly in the Congress, and the call by Hillary Rodham Clinton and the Knight Ridder News Agency reporting that it was Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security, and not Michael Brown, who was ultimately empowered to mobilize the federal response. response to the hurricane. But, Juan, today we're going to spend the hour on John Roberts. We're now in the fourth day of the hearing. We'll be playing excerpts of the hearing and going to two leading attorneys to talk about the significance of his responses.
Yes. Well, the U.S. Chief Justice nominee, John Roberts, was grilled for a second day himself at his Senate confirmation hearing for his views on a wide range of topics, but repeatedly declined to answer questions by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He claimed that those questions would come before the High Court. Roberts is widely expected to win approval from the Republican-controlled committee next Thursday. Republican senators ended their questions late yesterday, but agreed to let Democrats have another round today and then conclude the day with testimony from outside witnesses. The full Senate will vote by the end of the month. If confirmed, Roberts will be the youngest Chief Justice in over 200 years.
For over 8 hours on Wednesday, Roberts fielded senators' questions on an array of legal issues, including the death penalty, privacy, affirmative action, international law, and more. While he outlined his views on some issues, Roberts repeatedly declined to address numerous questions from Democratic committee members. In contrast, several Republicans defended Roberts' answers and began congratulating him as though he were already on the court. In a few minutes, we'll speak with two legal experts. But first, we'll play excerpts of Wednesday's hearings, and we'll begin with Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, who caught the public's eye when he became emotional on the first day of the hearings over the divisiveness between Democrats and Republicans. However, Coburn, a former doctor, has made controversial statements of his own. In July, he told the Associated Press, quote, "I favor the death penalty for abortionists and other people who take life." In 1992, a former 20-year-old patient filed a malpractice suit against him, charging he sterilized her without her consent. At Wednesday's hearing, Senator Coburn asked Roberts about foreign law. This is an excerpt.
My question to you is, relying on foreign precedent and selecting and choosing a foreign precedent to create a bias outside of the laws of this country, is that good behavior?
Well, for the reasons I stated yesterday, I don't think it's a good approach. I wouldn't accuse judges or justices who disagree with that, though, of violating their oath. I'd accuse them of getting it wrong on that point, and I'd hope to sit down with them and debate it and reason about it. But I think the justices who reach a contrary result on those questions are operating in good faith and trying, as I do on the court I am on now, to live up to that oath that you read. I wouldn't want to suggest that they're not doing that. I would think they're not getting it right in that particular case and with that particular approach, and would hope to be able to sit down and argue with it, as I suspect they'd like to sit down and debate with me. But I wouldn't suggest they're not operating in good faith to comply with it.
Can the American people count on you to not use foreign precedents in your decision-making on the Supreme Court?
I will follow the Supreme Court's precedents consistent with the principles of stare decisis. And there are cases in this area, of course. That's why we're having the debate. The court has looked at those. I think it's fair to say those in the prior opinions, those are not determinative in the sense that the precedent turned entirely on foreign law. So it's not a question of whether or not you'd be departing from these cases if you decided not to use foreign law. And for the reasons I gave yesterday, I'm going to be looking.
And I respect that, and I know that you can't be in a position to make a judgment on that.
John Roberts responding to questions from Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn. During the hearings Wednesday, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee, raised the issue of capital punishment. His questions to Roberts came just hours before death row prisoner Francis Newton was executed in Texas, killed by lethal injection shortly after 6 Texas time, despite widespread calls for her execution. While Leahy didn't specifically mention Newton's case, He did say that investigations into various death row cases have revealed drunk and sleeping lawyers, underfunded and indifferent lawyers, and a startling number of innocent men, he said, being sentenced to death who are later exonerated. After break, we'll go to that excerpt, and then we'll have a discussion with our guests. Stay with us.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over, well, now 375 radio and television stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Again, we turn now to Senator Leahy of Vermont questioning Judge John Roberts about the death penalty. And this just hours before Francis Newton was executed in Texas, despite widespread calls for a stay of that execution. Senator Leahy and John Roberts.
Is it your current personal view the death row inmate who can prove his innocence has no constitutional right to do so before a court, before he's executed?
Well, Senator, and this is the basis of the disagreement in Herrera. Herrera is not a case about actual innocence. Well, it's a question of whether you're entitled to bring a new claim.
But listen to my question. Does a death row inmate who can prove is innocent, do they have no constitutional right to do so in a court of law before they're executed?
Well, prove his innocence. The issue arises before you get to the question of proof. And the question is, do you allow someone who has raised several claims over the years to suddenly say at the last minute, somebody who just died was the person who committed the murder? And does that mean you start the trial all over again simply on the basis of that last-minute claim, or do you require more of a showing at that stage? That's what Herrera was about. Now, I don't think, of course, that anybody who is innocent should be suffer as a result of a false conviction. If they've been falsely convicted and they're innocent, they shouldn't be prison, let alone executed.
But does the Constitution permit the execution of an innocent person?
I would think not, but the question is never, do you allow the execution of an innocent person? The question is, do you allow particular claimants to raise different claims, fourth or fifth or sixth time, to say at the last minute, somebody who just died was actually the person who committed the murder, let's have a new trial? Or do you take into account the proceedings that have already gone on?
I'm looking for broad principles here. You said, let me read it again. Does the Constitution require that a prisoner have the right to seek judicial review of a claim of newly discovered evidence instead of being required to seek relief in the clemency process? In our view, the Constitution does not guarantee the prisoner such a right. Is that your view today?
Well, that's what the court held in Herrera.
Is that your view today?
Well, I'm not in a position to comment on the correctness or incorrectness of particular court decisions. That's the court's precedent in Herrera. It agreed with the administration position, which was not that innocent people should be subject to imprisonment or execution.
That's Judge John Roberts being questioned by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. We're joined in the Washington studio by Ted Shaw, Director Counsel and President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, as well as Peter Irons, Professor of Political Science, University of California, San Diego. Peter Irons is the author of numerous books, including A People's History of the Supreme Court and narrator of May It Please the Court. I wanted to welcome you both to Democracy Now! And go, Ted Shaw, to you first about this issue of the death penalty and Judge Roberts. How much was revealed? What is Herrera?
Well, first, it's good to be with you, Amy and Juan. And as we listened to that excerpt, I couldn't help but think about how Judge Roberts went to great lengths, really, to avoid answering that question. The question simply was whether someone who could show innocence could have a review of a state court conviction in federal court. And he talked about Herrera, this particular case, and went to the question of whether someone can point to somebody who just died. Well, that's not the question he was being asked. Here's the problem. I was up at the hearing yesterday for part of the day, and I think I heard Judge Roberts admit and acknowledge that there was a risk of executing innocent people. It seems to me if that risk is there, and we at the Legal Defense Fund know it's more than a risk, then I don't know how anybody could support the death penalty in this country. Now, that's miles away from where Judge Roberts is or where he's going to be. We at the Legal Defense Fund recently demonstrated that there was substantial evidence to show that somebody who had been executed, not somebody who was found innocent while staying on death row, somebody who had been executed was innocent. And we have the DA in St. Louis, Missouri, reopening an investigation to find out whether that's so. I was very troubled, and I have been troubled by Judge Roberts' testimony, not only on the issue of the death penalty, but on many other issues. He's very carefully parsing his language. He's not answering questions. We knew that before we came in. This is gamesmanship. But this is too important a position. I think we, as the American people, ought to know what his views are. If his views have changed, he should say so. If they haven't changed, he should say so.
Well, Ted Shaw, the questioning, this line of questioning was particularly relevant given the reality that Francis Newton was being executed that very day in Texas, a textbook case of what Senator Leahy was referring to in terms of the questions raised about innocence in a capital murder, capital punishment case. Yet Senator Leahy apparently was either oblivious to the situation or chose not to raise the Newton case as an example that would have driven the case home a lot more.
Well, two things are happening here, I think. One is that executions have become so commonplace, and Texas, of course, is leading the country in executions, that people just don't even pay attention to them anymore for the most part. Now, yesterday's execution was different because it was a black woman who was being executed. Most people who are being executed are men overwhelmingly, so it was a little bit different. But the second thing I want to point out is that, yes, we're concerned about innocence, but we're also concerned about a range of issues that arise in the imposition of the death penalty that go beyond the issue of innocence, that go to the issues of due process, issues of race discrimination, issues of poverty, issues of whether we have an even playing field in taking people's lives. While the Texas case that we saw yesterday end up in an execution could have been an example for Senator Leahy, I think that we don't want to focus only on the issue of innocence, although, of course, that's the most powerful issue.
On the issue of foreign law, international law, let's bring Peter Irons into this conversation. Your response to John Roberts' response.
Well, it's good to be with you, Amy and Juan. And the issue of foreign law is really interesting because the decisions the court has handed down in recent years in which foreign law was cited, not as binding precedent, because of course it isn't, but as evidence of a trend in other countries away from practices like executing juveniles or criminalizing consensual sex. These are cases in which the court is beginning to realize, Justice O'Connor, I think, leading among them, that we don't live anymore in an isolated world. This is part of a global system of law. International law has governed this country since its very founding. We have treaties that this administration says are not binding on us, for example, the Geneva Convention against Torture and Inhumane Treatment of Prisoners. And to the extent that other countries have advanced their understanding of the law in these fields, I think the Supreme Court should take account of those. Now, as Judge Roberts pointed out, these were not the determinative decisions of foreign courts that the court based its opinions on. But I think that to exclude that very strong evidence of changing attitudes, changing trends, changing facts, really robs the court of a source of law that it needs to take account of.
We're going to go now to the next excerpt. Judge John Roberts has served in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. He's argued more than three dozen cases before the Supreme Court. In one of them, he argued the Supreme Court should invalidate a federal affirmative action program. Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy raised the issue of affirmative action at the hearing. This is an excerpt.
In the Grutter v. Bollinger case, the Supreme Court decided, very close, 5-4 decision. Sandra Day O'Connor, the deciding individual, good justice, the Supreme Court upheld the university practices that considered race as one factor in its admission decisions. No one is talking today about quotas. We're talking about affirmative action as defined in this Grutter decision. The court found that there was a constitutional affirmative action program aimed at achieving a racially diverse student body. In this decision, the court expressly gave great weight to the representation by military leaders, that said highly qualified, racially diverse officer corps is essential to the military's ability to fulfill its principal mission and to provide national security. What weight would you give to that kind of a comment or statement or testimony by the military in considering any issue dealing with affirmative action?
Well, the weight it was given was to help satisfy the test, because the court, as you know, in Grutter, applied strict scrutiny because it was dealing with considerations on the basis of race. And that required a showing of a compelling governmental interest to support that legislative action. And the testimony of the military officers, as the court explained, helped substantiate the compelling nature of the interest in having a diverse student body. And that was the weight that the court gave it. There was, of course, the other case. There were two Michigan cases, the law school case and the university case, the Gratz case, where the court did say that it looked too much like a quota in that case because it was given determinative consideration as opposed to being one of a variety of factors that is considered. And the two cases together kind of show where the court is coming out, at least in the area of higher education. The court permits consideration of race or ethnic background so long as it's not sort of a make-or-break test.
Well, do you agree then with Justice O'Connor, writing for the majority, that gave great weight to the real-world impact of affirmative policies in universities? And the reason I've got 35 seconds left, that you might say, well, this may eventually come on up before the court, but the fact is We know how every other justice has voted because they've all voted. And the American people would like to know where you stand on this very important public policy issue, particularly since Sandra Day O'Connor wrote such a compelling decision that was, I think, in the cause of fairness and justice.
Well, Senator, I think I can answer the specific questions you asked, because as you phrased the question, do you agree with her that it's important to look at the real world significance and impact? And I can certainly say that I do think that that is the appropriate approach, without commenting on the outcome or the judgment in a particular case, that you do need to look at the real world impact in this area, and I think in other areas as well.
Senator Ted Kennedy asking Judge Roberts questions about affirmative action. Ted Shaw, you're president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Your response to this interaction?
Well, first, I was deeply involved in the Michigan cases. I was one of the faculty members at one time at the University of Michigan Law School and helped to draft the policy that was under attack and upheld. And I was also lead counsel for Black and Latino students in the undergraduate case. I want to say that this struggle is not over. That is to say that the issue of affirmative action will come back to the court. If Judge Roberts had said that he didn't want to opine on it for that reason, he's probably right. It will come back to the court at one time or another. His answer, again, carefully parsed. He talked about taking account of real-world impact, which seems to suggest that he might be on all fours with Justice O'Connor. But he didn't make that commitment. You don't know how he's going to vote on the issue of affirmative action if it comes back to the court. We do know he has been a harsh critic of affirmative action in the past. He's talked about people who apply for employment and who get affirmative action consideration as unqualified at one time. Whether those are his views now or not, we're not entirely sure, because he's refused to really directly address that. So the problem we've had at the Legal Defense Fund is in determining what he believes now, but we know what he believed then. And what he believed then is part of an overall pattern of hostility to civil rights.
And Peter Irons, in terms of these questions that are raised, because the nominee is so reluctant to be able to put forth his views, how then do senators, how do they make judgments as to whether he would make an appropriate person to be Chief Justice?
Well, I don't think there's any surprise in the way that Judge Roberts has responded to the questioning. I was thinking it's sort of like nailing Jell-O to the wall. He tries very, very carefully and very skillfully to avoid giving any views that might predict the way he would vote on any particular issue or cases before the court. But this is all part of a very carefully choreographed exercise. It's sort of like a kabuki play. Judge Roberts has been instructed, and I think would on his own anyway, carefully avoid giving his views in any substantive way. He's making the most general kind of comments that I think people on both sides of an issue could agree with, carefully avoiding what happened during the confirmation hearings, for example, for Judge Bork, which is probably one reason why no nominee since then has ventured to give his or her views on issues that might come before the court. But in another sense, I think that the members of the committee are also playing their roles in this play. The Democrats are trying very hard to score points that resonate with their constituencies, with women, gays and lesbians, African Americans and other minorities, Hispanics. And the Republicans, as Senator Coburn showed, are responding to their core constituency, these very conservative, many of them evangelical Christians who want the court to change direction radically. Of course, Judge Roberts is almost in the exact mold as Chief Justice Rehnquist, not only as his former clerk, but in many other ways. So his addition to the court, the only significant factor, I think, as was pointed out, he would be the youngest Chief Justice since John Marshall, who was only 48 when he joined the court. And so the prospect is that he would sit on the court for quite a long time. And during that time, of course, there will be new justices appointed. And we need to find out what the trend is going to be, whether the candidates will be somewhat in the mainstream or whether they will be the kind of ideologues that the president and his administration want on the court.
Well,
if Peter, I may.
Yes, Ted Shaw.
If I may, just to amplify on that, I think we are getting, as best we can tell, a Rehnquist for Rehnquist. The key seat, of course, is going to be the O'Connor seat in terms of the swing vote. But when we say we're getting Rehnquist for Rehnquist, what we're seeing is somebody who's replacing a justice or chief justice who, when he came to the court, was an outlier. So it's a mistake to forget that Chief Justice Rehnquist was very, very conservative. And I think that John Roberts, at best, is in that mold.
I wanted to play just an excerpt of Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold late in the day yesterday raising the issue of gay rights with Judge John Roberts.
Congress has the power under the Constitution to prohibit discrimination against gays and lesbians in employment.
I don't know if that's an issue that's going to come before the courts. I don't know if Congress has taken that step yet. And until it does, I think that's an issue that I have to maintain some silence on. I think, personally, I believe that everybody should be treated with dignity in this area and respect.
Judge Roberts responding to a question on gay rights. Later we'll play New York Democrat Charles Schumer expressing frustration on the lack of answers of Judge Roberts. And we'll also look at prisoners' rights and the Geneva Conventions. We're taking a look in this hour at the responses of Judge John Roberts with Ted Shaw, president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and Peter Irons, author of A People's History of the Supreme Court. We'll be back in a minute.
Pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation. Triumphantly, won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? All I ever had, redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop Jah-Tah. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Oh, well, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill Jabo. Won't you help us say?
Sweet Honey and the Rock Redemption Song here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue this hour looking at Judge John Roberts, day four today of the confirmation hearings that would, if Judge Roberts succeeds in being confirmed, would make him the youngest Supreme Court Justice of the United States in over 200 years. Yesterday, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer expressed great frustration about the lack of answers to the senator's questions.
But when you add it all up, you are being less forthcoming. I know you're doing what you feel is right, but you're being less forthcoming with this committee than just about any other person who has come before us. You are so bright, and you know so much, But there's another aspect to this, which is letting us know what you think. And you've set up your own little construct. It's not really the Ginsburg precedent, or it isn't Canon 5, which you cited repeatedly at your Court of Appeals hearing. And so let me ask you this one question, and then you can answer it in general. Has there been any judge that you're aware of who's had to recuse himself or herself because of what they said at a confirmation hearing? Can you name for me a judge who you think was biased or not able to render justice because they gave their opinion at a confirmation hearing sitting at this table as you do?
I think because the justices have followed the approach that I am following, and as I said, I've gone back and read every one of the transcripts for the justices, they have avoided commenting on whether they think decisions were correctly decided or not.
Judge John Roberts responding to Senator Schumer. Juan?
Well, just 1 week before his nomination to the Supreme Court in July, John Roberts was part of a three-judge panel that handed Bush an important victory in the so-called War on Terror. It ruled that the military tribunals of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, could proceed. The decision also found that Bush could deny terrorism captives prisoner of war status, as outlined by the Geneva Conventions.
The case was brought by Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a citizen of Yemen who was captured during fighting in Afghanistan, the government says, and then held at Guantanamo. At Wednesday's hearing, Roberts came under scrutiny for ruling on the Hamdan case by Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold.
You interviewed with the Attorney General of the United States concerning a possible opening on the Supreme Court on April 1, 2005. Is that correct?
Yes. The specifics of the details I've discussed in the response to the committee's questionnaire.
And that was 6 days before the oral argument in the Hamdan case. Isn't that right?
I don't remember the exact date of it. I know it was shortly before that, yeah.
You had further interviews on May 3rd concerning a possible appointment to the court with numerous White House officials, including Karl Rove, the Vice President, and the White House counsel before the decision in the Hamdan case was released. Isn't that correct?
The decision was June 15th.
The question here is just, did you have further interviews on May 3rd concerning a possible appointment to the
May
court?
May 3rd, yes. Whatever was, I don't remember the exact dates, but whatever
you
was
had interviews with those individuals.
In the Senate
record seems to
correct.
Indicate it was on May 3rd. You met again with Ms. Myers, the White House counsel, on May 23rd, isn't that right?
I'm relying on the, if that's what I said in the questionnaire, yes.
You have no reason to doubt that those facts are correct. You never informed counsel in this case of these meetings, did you?
I did not, no.
Mr. Gonzalez's advice to the President concerning the Geneva Conventions was an issue in the case. Isn't that right?
I don't want to discuss anything about what's at issue in the case. The case is still pending and pending before the Supreme Court.
Well, how about
Court.
This one? President Bush was named a defendant in the case, right?
Yes. In his official capacity.
The Hamdan decision was released on July 15th. Is it your testimony that no work on that decision took place after July 1?
No, I didn't. That was not my testimony. The opinions in the D.C. Circuit...
Oh, is it your testimony now that no work on that decision took place after July 1?
Opinions in the D.C. Circuit are complete and circulated to the panel a week before they're released. That was my... The conclusion of when work was complete... and again, I wasn't the author of the opinion. Mm-hmm. Would have been a week before it was released.
Did you read over the opinion of the concurrence after July 1? Was there any editing that took place after that date?
I don't recall, Senator. And
but when was the issue of whether you should recuse yourselves from this case? When did that first come to your attention?
I saw and was made aware of an article. I think it was an article. I don't remember when that took place, whenever the article was published. And then I understand there was legal opinions on the other side were requested by, I believe, the chairman. And I know that those were published.
You don't recall
well.
When this matter first came up and would think would be something you'd remember is when suggested you should have recused yourself.
I don't remember the date of the...
How about the approximate time?
It was. I think it was sometime in July or...
Judge Roberts being questioned by Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold about an issue of a conflict of interest. The judge ruling on this three-judge panel in favor of the Bush administration, handing President Bush a critical victory in the administration's execution of the so-called war on terror. Peter Irons, you're author of People's History of the United States, longtime law professor. Do you think there's a conflict of interest here? As he was making this ruling, he was meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney. He was meeting with Andrew Card. He was meeting with Attorney General Gonzalez, who's one of his top deputies, was arguing this case before the Supreme Court, and Judge Roberts was being considered for the highest job in the land.
Well, this is one of the most disturbing aspects of the whole nomination. I've just finished a book called War Powers, How the Imperial Presidency Hijacked the Constitution. And a major theme in that book is the amazing increase in executive power in this field, particularly the administration's claims, really, that it's above the law. In dealing with people who are alleged to be enemy combatants. And I think that Judge Roberts, by participating in the selection process for his nomination while this issue was pending before his court, and as the excerpt showed, it got down to details of which day the opinion was completed and so forth, but he wasn't really forthcoming about this basic issue, that is, of war powers. And I think it's quite clear that on the court he would be, as he has been all along, from his early service in the Bush administration and before that the Reagan administration, an advocate of almost unlimited executive powers in the field of foreign policy and war powers. And I think that that would be consistent, of course, with the position of Chief Justice Rehnquist. It wouldn't change the outcome. But the question of whether he should have recused himself is a significant issue, I don't think his answer was very responsive to the series of questions from Senator Feingold.
Amy, I'd just add that
Ted Shaw, president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Lawyers and judges have ethical responsibilities not only to avoid actual conflicts, but to avoid perceived conflicts of interest. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that somebody who wants to be on the Supreme Court may appear to curry favor, even if they actually are not intending to do so, with the president, with the White House, in going a certain way on a decision and being a good soldier. So I think it's a serious, serious question that was raised. And as Peter said, I don't think that it was really answered adequately.
I'd like to ask Peter Irons, one of the areas in which Judge Roberts did give some indication of his views was on an issue that really is affecting scores and scores of communities all over the United States, is the issue of eminent domain and the recent court decision that the government has the right to take people's properties for private developments or for private owners. And, of course, it's a decision where, amazingly, the more liberal members of the court sided with the government and the more conservative members of the court were in the minority on the issue. And Judge Roberts did seem to at least begin to give some perspective of what his views might be on this.
Well, this is a fascinating issue, the takings clause of the Constitution, that private property may not be taken without fair compensation. But, and as you point out, the liberals on the court upheld the powers of government. This is an area, of course, that raises federalism issues because most of these takings are done by states and local government. And I think that Judge Roberts, to the extent that he did express his views on this, would most likely side, I think, with those who feel that the government has overreached itself. One of the interesting things about this decision, the Kahlo case, is that the public response to it was overwhelmingly negative, that the court had done something that undermined every property owner's right, every homeowner's right to hold their property and use it. And that government shouldn't just gobble it up in the interests of corporate development and expanding their tax base. So I think that perhaps, as Judge Roberts' answers to these questions indicated, that he is a little more sensitive to the impact of the court's decisions on public opinion.
But Juan, if I may, on this issue, though, this is one that's very confusing to a lot of people. And here's why you see some of the more, quote, liberal, end quote, justices going the way they did in this case. This is about a movement by conservatives to say that any regulation of any kind, whether it's environmental, whether it's civil rights, is a taking of property. So, for example, somebody owns a building and they rent out housing in it. The Fair Housing Act says you can't discriminate. Well, that might be a taking. That's why you see liberals going that way and conservatives going another way, because what we have here is an underlying question that confuses a lot of people. On both sides of the fence, at the end of the day, a lot of people are upset about the opinion. At the Legal Defense Fund, we've represented poor minority people who've had their property taken. And on this one, I think that Justice Thomas was absolutely correct. It's poor and minority people who will be the most vulnerable, although everyone is at risk here. But there's an underlying ideological struggle that I think most people don't understand about regulation.
As we come to the conclusion of this hour, we're also today coming to the conclusion of this confirmation hearing. If Judge Roberts is confirmed, he will be the youngest Chief Justice of the United States in more than 200 years. I wanted to ask each of you for your thoughts on what this means, and if you were sitting there as one of the senators, what questions you think would be critical. It might surprise a number of people that these hearings have not been more contentious. Ted Shaw, president of the NAACP.
Well, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, we're separate from the NAACP. But the question, I think, is an opportunity for me to point to a report that the Legal Defense Fund has issued. It's available on our website, which is www.naacpldf.org. And the questions that I would ask if I was on the Senate would go to his views, whether all of these views, this fellow has a record, an extensive record. He's very bright. But his views and what they are now. Now, they're trying to get at that. The problem in the Senate is that often we don't get the kind of penetrating follow-up and cross-examination. Part of it is a problem of format, but part of it, I think, is the kind of nature of the political game. With respect to the significance of this appointment as Chief Justice, he's going to be there for a long time, assuming good health. And he's going to guide the court. He's going to have an impact on the judiciary. But people grow, they change, and we don't really know who he's going to be 10 years from now, 5 years from now, much less 30 years from now. All we know is the record that he has now. I would not let him get away with the statement that the views that we have seen him articulate were only the views of his bosses. These were clearly his views, and I think that they have to keep going after him on that. It's just about over now.
Let me ask Peter Irons.
He's going to be confirmed.
Peter Irons, we only have 15 seconds. Your response.
Well, I think that the real question, assuming that he's confirmed, is he going to be more in the mold of Chief Justice Rehnquist, or will he evolve in his views? People thought that Justice Harry Blackmun and Justice Anthony Kennedy were going to turn out to be predictable conservatives, but their views evolved. They became more aware, as Judge Roberts said, of real-world issues. And to the extent that he can remain open to those kinds of factors and not be locked into a sort of ideological closet with Scalia and Thomas, there's some hope in my mind that over time.
Peter Irons, I'm going to have to cut you off. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks all for being with us.